Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. In the last 30 years, there's been a revolution in our scientific understanding of babies and young children, a revolution that has transformed our understanding of being human itself. Why are babies such babies? It's a big part of being human. Dr. Allison Gopnik joins us to discuss new discoveries and their implications in the way that we think about young children and ourselves. Allison, welcome to The Source.
Welcome. Glad to be here.
Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question about child brain development, give us a call, 614-8980, 614-8980. So human beings have a longer childhood than any other animal. And so babies, you know, they're helpless and dependent for so long. You know, they don't, you know, like you have a fold of a horse. They're up and walking and be able to be mobile. They're still dependent on the mother for nutrition, but still they are at least ambulatory. So why are human babies so dependent upon moms to take care of them?
Well, that's a good question, and it might seem sort of puzzling from an evolutionary perspective, because why is it that our babies are so helpless, so useless, even sort of worse than useless, because we have to work so hard just to take care of them? And the interesting thing is that if you look across the animal kingdom, it turns out that there's a relationship between how helpless the babies are and how smart the adults are. So the longer the period of childhood, the longer the period of immaturity, the better the adult animals are at learning and the bigger the brains are that they have. And that's not just true for people. It's true about birds. It's true about marsupials in Australia. It's true about just about every animal that we know about. And, of course, we human beings are way off on the end of the spectrum. We are helpless. Our babies are helpless for much longer. My son is 25, and at least until they're 25, we're writing tuition checks and taking care of them.
So is the cutoff when they can do their own laundry, we know they're no longer helpless.
And of course, as adults, we're also the smartest and the best at learning about different environments. And we think that there's actually a relationship between those two things. So here's the picture. The idea is that the children are really designed for learning. That's what they're there for. They're there to have a period where they don't have to worry about taking care of themselves or eating or any of those things. They can just explore the world, consider as many different possibilities as they can. They're really just designed for learning. One of the things that I say is it's as if children are the research and development division of the human species, and we adults are production and marketing. They're really designed to figure out what's going on in the world around them.
You know, I do want to mention that you're giving a lecture later today at 6:30 at the Pearl Stable, and it's for the Mind Science Foundation, and it's free for members of the Mind Science Foundation. And the name of the lecture is The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. And we're going to get into that in a second. I want to stay on this topic about this. Now, elephants, I mean, their gestation period is 2 years. Mm-hmm. So that's a big mammal with a pretty good-sized brain. And so with humans, I thought that the fact was that once in evolution, that once the human's brain and the skull began to grow larger, became too large for the birth canal. And so evolution started making so that the child was born earlier. And so basically we had to have sort of outside the womb gestation of a child that is born, but is still very dependent on the mother outside of the womb.
Well, that's part of the story, but it's not really the whole story, because when you look, for instance, at our evolution from comparing early humans to Neanderthals, for example, you see this difference in the length of childhood, even looking at the difference between us and our closest ancestors. And as I say, you see the same relationship even in birds. So, for example, crows, everyone kind of knows that crows are really, really smart birds, and chickens, with apologies to any chicken lovers in the audience, are really not very swift birds. And the crow babies are fledglings for much longer. So they don't have the issue about trying to get that big head through a mammal's hips. But you still see this relationship between the long period of immaturity and the intelligence and flexibility and the large brain on the part of the adult. So we think it isn't just about physically getting that big brain out. It's about having a brain that's able to be shaped by what's going on around you. And it's interesting that along with that goes the fact that we've evolved much more of what people call adult investment in our children. We put a lot more time and energy into taking care of them, and not just mothers, but fathers and grandmothers and other people among human beings are all really involved in investing in taking care of those helpless children. Now, it turns out that when we actually look at what those children are doing in that long helpless period, it might seem like, well, they're just sort of sitting around and playing and having a good time, and they are. But what we've discovered is just that sitting around and playing, they're using learning mechanisms that are as impressive and powerful as those of the greatest scientists and the most powerful computers that we know of.
Now, this is also the period of imprinting that of the baby on the mother and the mother on the baby and creating an incredible bond. The baby studying the mother's face during nursing, and just it just seems that there's not just intelligent learning, but emotional learning that's going on.
Well, one of the things that I'm going to talk about, which is one of the most interesting things we've discovered, is that children aren't just figuring out how the physical world around them works. One of the most important things they're figuring out is how the minds of other people work and how people's emotions work and how things like love work. And even tiny babies, even 18-month-olds, are already figuring things out, like the fact that sometimes people don't want all the same things. In an experiment that we did in my lab, what we did was we showed babies two bowls of food, one bowl of raw broccoli and one bowl of goldfish crackers. And the children all liked the goldfish crackers a lot more than they liked the broccoli. But then we showed them an adult either taking a little bit of food and either acting as if she liked it or she didn't. So either, you know, yum, broccoli, or oh, yuck, broccoli. And then we gave the babies the bowl. The adult put her hand out and we said, can you give me some? Now, the question is, would the babies give the grown-up what she likes or what they like? And even 18-month-olds are already taking the perspective of the other person, understanding, oh, I guess this is crazy. I don't know why, but she likes broccoli, so I'm going to give her broccoli. And figuring that out, figuring things out like what's going on in somebody else's mind, what does somebody want, what does somebody think, that's a tremendously important thing for children to learn.
Now, children, actually, they taste different than adults. Bitter is much more bitter for them, and sweet is much more sweet for them. And so you have to kind of think about what is their sensory input like for them as you consider how they are taking in the world.
Right. Well, what we've discovered is that it isn't just their immediate experience. The children, from the time they're very little, are already thinking in a more abstract way. They can already think about things like cause and effect from the time they're 18-month-olds, even 18 months old. Even little toddlers are figuring out, well, okay, I guess that the broccoli made her make that happy face, so she must like the broccoli, even if that seems really different.
So you're
from
saying
my
they
experience.
Have empathy, they're able to think about other people. And this is at child. What age was this experiment done?
The experiment was actually, this is interesting, it was with 15 and 18-month-olds, and the 18-month-olds were very good at doing this. The 15-month-olds, not so much. So the 15-month-olds would give her the crackers all the time, whether okay. She liked the broccoli or not.
Right, so we're going to continue, and Cheerios, it's another thing that they give away. All right, we're going to continue our conversation about child brain development. We've got Dr. Allison Gupnik. She's with the Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. She has a lecture tonight at the Pearl Stable with the Mind Science Foundation. This is The Source on KSTX. We will be right back. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. In the studio with me, Dr. Allison Gupnik. She's the author of a couple of books, Words, Thoughts, and Theories, The Science of the Crib, and the forthcoming The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Love, Truth, and the Meaning of Life. One reason that I'm very interested and curious about child brain development is because it seems to me that, there are windows that seem to open and close in a child's mind. You can kind of see sometimes they suddenly become the super sponge, and they're really absorbing information at a high rate, and other times maybe not so much. They're more focused on their immediate needs. And it would do all of us a great bit of good if we could figure out how to maximize the times when their brains are turned into the super sponge input. I can absorb this information. I can take it all in. Give me more, more, more. How do we? Is there any clues? How can we help our children hit that super sponge level?
Right. Well, I think the main thing that we've discovered is that we don't really have to make our children any smarter, because the children are already naturally about as smart as they can be. And in fact, if anything, what happens is that we kind of get stupider as we get older. At least if you're thinking about being able to learn something new, something you haven't anticipated before. So from the perspective of children, when children are learning the most is when they're playing, when they're exploring, when they're finding out about things in the world. And often the things that they're learning about, like learning about what people want, aren't things that we would ever even think about trying to teach them or getting them to know about. So I think the important thing is that when children are in a protected environment where they feel safe, where they don't have to worry about their immediate needs, that's the context in which they can unleash these really incredible, powerful learning abilities that we know about. So just sit and watch a toddler playing sometime, and you'll see that in that everyday play, he's doing a whole bunch of experiments that would put the best scientist to shame. Just count up how many things he's finding out in a really short period of time.
So you say that if you can keep your child in a low anxiety environment, make him feel safe and secure, then that window of learning will maybe stay open a little wider, stay open a little longer, and you can help them learn a lot more. But, children and language is fascinating. And the way they do pre-language and play with language and are able to and they master language. As an adult, you try to learn a new language, and you never lose your original accent, and you're always still going to fumble through. How is it that children are so good at picking up language?
Well, this is one of the great mysteries, because it's a bit like, hummingbirds. We know that they can do it, but we still haven't quite figured out how it's possible for them to do so much. But what we know is that children are amazingly good at picking up patterns, at looking for rules. And part of what we've been doing in the research in my lab and in other labs is trying to figure out, how do children do that? How do they take very, very complicated data pattern? And we think they're kind of like little scientists. They're picking up, here's the statistics, here's this pattern, and then pulling out that pattern from the data. And it's interesting, because often it's the mistakes that they make that are most revealing. So my adorable little grandson the other day said to me, held up his finger, which had a little cut on it, and said, "I'm sharp." And I said, "What?" And then, of course, I realized, oh, no, wait a minute, that makes sense. You say, "I'm hot." Why shouldn't you say, "I'm sharp," when you mean that you have a little cut and you're hurting? So he'd actually been smarter than I was. He realized that you could say things like, "I'm sharp," even if boring old grown-ups might not realize that.
Yeah, his brain was sharp, at least, in figuring that out. But you say that toddlers can analyze statistics and do experiments and that are more powerful than those of the smartest scientists and even the most advanced computers. It kind of seems like you're overselling what these little kids can do, because they're just figuring out the world, and it's pretty much through trial and error, and maybe they're modeling behavior somewhat, but still, we love to romanticize the baby and think that is the closest to nature and close to perfection, but maybe not so much.
Well, what we've actually discovered is that it depends on what you mean by what you're talking about, right? So there are plenty of skills that we have as adults, like tying our shoes, for example, that children are really bad at. They're bad at deferring gratification. They're bad at focusing their attention. But if you think about things like being able to learn something new, learn something that you've never learned before, or being able to make up a new hypothesis just based on a little bit of data that you have, or being able to think about something and then predict something completely different, like "I'm sharp," or "she doesn't like broccoli." It turns out that those kind of simple explanations, maybe they're imitating or maybe they're associating ideas, just can't explain just how much it is that children are learning. And what we've discovered over the last 10 years or so is when we give children, part of the problem is that we've been asking children in our language instead of their language. So if you ask a 3-year-old to tell you what they're thinking, you'll get a beautiful poem about ponies and birthdays, but they won't sound like they're very smart. But when instead of that, you do things like look at what they reach for, give them an experiment in real life, and then see what they do, it turns out that they really are incredibly smart. And they're using, their brains are using methods of inferring and learning that really do put to shame those of the best computer scientists. So they're not very good at lots of things that we're good at as adults, but there are some things like just being able to learn and imagine that where they really do seem to be much, much better than we ever would have thought. That's been the big scientific discovery.
Yeah, just as an experiment, I played chess against a baby the other day, and I beat them almost every time. Our phone lines are open. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. If you got a question about child brain development, we're speaking with Dr. Allison Gupnik. She's going to be speaking tonight at the Pearl's Table at the Mind Science Foundation's lecture, The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Love, Truth, and the Meaning of Life. So what do babies know about the meaning of life?
Well, when I wrote that as the subtitle for my book, I, of course, assumed that people were going to recognize that that was a little bit ironic. But I come from California, where we're not too good at irony. So people keep asking me, how does the meaning of life come into it? And here's what I think. When you think about a lot of the kind of big spiritual questions that we ask, things like, what's meaningful? What makes my life meaningful? How will I continue after I'm no longer here? What's something I care about more than I care about myself? Actually, when you think about it, and when you ask most people in everyday life, they'd say, you know, I care more about my kids than I care about anything else. That's taking care of my kids is the thing that gives my life meaning. The fact that my children and their children are going to continue after I die, that's really important and significant to me. So I think in practice, our relationships to our children are the sources of really deep, profound feelings. And we kind of downplay that because it's something we so much take for granted. We say, well, yeah, of course we love our kids. But you think about it a little more, it's actually a really deep, profound part of our lives.
Well, you sacrifice a lot for them. You put many of your dreams on hold, and you do all you can to give them the future that you didn't have. So, you know, you do find meaning and grounding and direction and from having children.
Well, one of the things that I say is, you know, if you look at what every parent does in terms of the amount that they sacrifice, the way that they take care of their children, even just not great parents, just an okay parent, we never would do that for any other person. If you did that for any other person, you'd be the definition of a saint. So one of the things I say is hanging out with a two-year-old is a good way to exercise a little bit of saintliness.
Yeah, and so in return, the children are spoiled brats, and they're not very thankful. So they are self-absorbed. Children, you know, the little infants, they see themselves as the center of the universe. I mean, how can they be teaching us about love and truth if they are the center of the universe?
Well, it turns out that they don't think of themselves as being the center of the universe. From the time they're born, they're already empathizing with other people. For example, from the time they're born, they already imitate the facial expressions that they see other people produce. So if you stick out your tongue at the baby will stick his tongue out at you. And that means that from the time they're born, they're mapping, oh, okay, this is the way other people work. I guess this should be the way that I work too. And from the time they're 15 months old, they're doing things like going out of their way to help other people. So there's some lovely experiments that show that, for instance, if you drop a pencil on the ground, a 15-month-old will crawl over a bunch of cushions and take a detour to get the pencil and give it back to the grown-up. So they're already sensing what other people are like and trying to help other people to get what they want. So some of the origins of what we think of as morality are already there much, much earlier than we would have thought in the past.
If I see a child playing, what are the clues I should be looking for to see what's going on with this child's mind?
Well, one of the things that we've discovered is that when you see children just doing everyday play, say picking up something and shaking it and moving it onto the other side, or that everyday play like taking apart the transistor radio, that what they're doing is very systematically trying to figure out how the things around them work. And the things that they're playing with, that they like to play with the most at any particular age, tend to be the things that they're learning the most about. So very little ones will you know, spend hours with a bunch of mixing bowls trying to figure out what's large and what's small, or figuring out how gravity works with a bunch of blocks. And older children will start pretending. They'll start doing things like having crazy imaginary friends.
And doing role playing.
Exactly. And we know that that crazy imaginary friend play actually helps them figure out how people work. So they're trying to solve this problem of other people, and pretending is a good way to do it.
I want to get this caller on the line. Kathy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. With children learning things so early and learning from the people around them, how much does abuse and neglect affect the rest of their lives?
Oh, Kathy, great question. Appreciate that.
Yeah, that is a great question. And there's quite a lot of evidence that early abuse and neglect can have consequences that go on all the way through life. There's also some evidence that there's some resilience, though. So, for example, a famous example is the orphans in Romania who were very badly neglected in the first few years of life, but then were adopted by people in England. And most of those children, once they were adopted, actually came out fine, although they were somewhat more at risk than otherwise. I think the problem is that most children who are abused and neglected are going to continue to grow up in bad circumstances, and there's this kind of cycle of deprivation.
Allison Gupnik, doctor, she's going to be giving a lecture tonight at Pearl Stable from the Mind Science Foundation. This is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.